Hello, everyone. Dan Dillman here, bringing you a little of this, a little of that. Today's program, we will talk about heat islands, good fire, and if we get there, mental colonization. Those are just three of the topics that lie ahead. So let's get underway with number one. We're going to talk about urban heat islands. Because cities are subject to large-scale weather phenomena that we meet, some effects are the cities alone. The millions of tons of asphalt and hard rectilinear architecture form a unique relationship with the elements. The sun warms the buildings and the roads more efficiently than most natural substances. So the city warms more quickly and reaches higher temperatures on sunny days. The dark materials absorb more solar radiation, but the buildings also present a larger surface area. At the beginning of the day, the low sun can heat a skyscraper much more effectively than it can a tree. And at the end of the day, as the heat radiates quickly out of the surrounding areas, the buildings and roads act as heat batteries, which now release the heat back into the city. Water that coats trees in the countryside, cooling them through evaporation, runs quickly off steel and glass surfaces and down the drains in cities. Then there's human activity, the heating, industry, and vehicles. Together, these effects combine to create what is called an urban heat island, an effect that can make cities over 20 degrees Fahrenheit warmer than the surrounding countryside. As I may have said earlier, localized heating creates cumulus clouds. They bubble up above the cities, then bend or march slowly with the breeze. The heat island also creates its own winds. As the warmer city air expands and rises, the cycle we saw with sea breezes kicks in. Cooler air from the suburbs flows into the city. On a warm, clear, sunny day, little apparent wind in the early morning, the city starts to make its own, and a gentle breeze will flow towards the city center by mid-afternoon, and this is called the city breeze. The city breeze will be felt only on days when there is little or no main wind. If a light main wind is blowing, the downwind side of a city will be several degrees warmer than the windward side. But a strong wind removes the heat island effect altogether, which means temperature drops are exaggerated in urban areas. If after a summer high, and a few days of very warm, calm weather, a front goes through, that front robs the city not just of the sun's warmth, but the whole heat island effect. In one day, we go from seeing people's skin in the parks to coats on hunched shoulders. And a little bit more about the city. Cities are divisive. in terms of weather. They split the weather that tries to pass over them. From the vantage point of a tall building, for example, you can watch rain approaching your city, only to see it break into two and pass on either side of the center. Now, this happens for two main reasons. First, this is related to the heat island, the city breeze phenomena that we've just encountered. The hot city creates a pillar of warm, unstable, convective rising air. The wind is jostled by these columns of rising air. And if the heat island effect is strong enough, it is forced around the pillar and it splits. The second reason is that tall buildings trip the wind. They turn a smooth flowing wind into a turbulent, chaotic one. This can act as a barrier against the normal flow of the wind, which is then forced around the turbulence. These two effects can team up and even split storm systems in two. Any weather that is split by a city often joins back together downwind of the city. So there's a lot going on up there in the atmosphere. It's fascinating to watch. More about this in another program. And now we're going to take a short break before I come back and talk about the subject of good fire. Back again. This time, I'm going to talk about good fire. After all of the runaway blazes that have been occurring this year out west, but even in the rest of the country as well, there is good fire, but can it be trusted? The bear that's dressed in a ranger hat and jeans has stood the test of time. Introduced during World War II, Smokey Bear still reminds Americans that only you can prevent wildfires. But many forest and fire experts see a role for periodically starting a controlled or prescribed burn. This is called good fire. These terms refer to regulated burning for land management goals. In an era of increasingly frequent and larger wildfires that are linked in part to climate change, fire ecologists say it's a mitigation measure to trust. Prescribed fire is one of their best tools. Research supports the effectiveness of fuel treatments like prescribed fire, especially when combined with thinning, such as tree cutting to reduce density of the forest, which some find controversial. Many experts argue that more than a century of fire exclusion has actually made lands more prone to wildfire. Prescribed fire has widest use at the moment in the southeastern states, where Florida is an early adopter and has lowered legal liability for landowners who set controlled burns. Proponents call for increased use of this treatment to use in drought-racked western states. Prescribed fire fans say a record of security is there, provided by Good Fires. Figures from the U.S. Forest Service, which runs the largest federal prescribed fire program, indicate its burns rarely go off the rails. And out of 86,000 fires ignited by the Forest Service between 2003 and 2021, the agency counted only 128 that were declared wildfires, or in their parlance, escapes. That's less than 1%. And yet, escapes make headlines. But what can be done to sustain public trust in the so-called good fire? Prescribed burning won't eliminate wildfires on its own. And experts say it's important for messengers, that is, agencies and scientists and journalists, to highlight not just benefits, but also risks. Beyond escapes, those include potential air quality and health impacts from prescribed fire. Fire historian Stephen Pine said, "I think the best approach on trust is to take people out to sites and show them what we're doing and why and what the consequences of not doing it may be." Well, that supports research that found familiarity with land management was a key factor in public approval, and was understanding for understanding ecological benefits. It helps to recall that fire lightning has been a constant fact of human evolution. In the fire historian's words, quote, "This is what we do that no other creature does," unquote. Interesting article. It's taken from the Christian Science Monitor Weekly of August the 15th this year. Now we're going to explore mental colonization. This comes about after cultural invasion. For example, in the Ukraine. Right now, Ukraine is de-Russifying its urban memorials. Let me explain what I mean. Northeast of Lviv, its city center is among the maze-like bending streets where a small road leads past European villas and a playground. Parked cars parallel the wide sidewalks, and rose bushes and cedar trees decorate boutique gardens. So this street, one of Lviv's most posh and most European, was named after Russian novelist Leo Tolstoy, or until recently, anyway. In the last several months, a city commission has studied the 1,000 or so streets in the city, which is in the western part of Ukraine, and selected 53, including Tolstoy Street. And these will be renamed. The reason, says the commission head and the deputy mayor, Andrei Moskalenko, is decolonization. Streets like these were named during Russian rule as emblems of Russian superiority. Those names, he says, reinforce a kind of mental colonization. 30 years after the fall of the USSR, almost every Ukrainian city still has Russian or Soviet memorials. They're mostly street or square names. And while past protest movements brought down political monuments like statues of Vladimir Lenin, those honoring artists like Leo Tolstoy or Pyotr Tchaikovsky weren't as controversial. But then came February 24th, 2022. Russian President Vladimir Putin justified the invasion of Ukraine that began that day in part by claiming Ukrainians and Russians are the same people. Now, to Ukrainians, that's another way of saying their nation doesn't exist. Many in the country now see this conflict as another attempt to erase their culture. It's no different than decades of Soviet rule when Ukraine's artists were executed, their literature suppressed, and Russia's invasion was to them a literal culture war. Well, like Lviv, cities across the country have founded commissions to identify Russian or Soviet monuments and recommend which ones should be changed. The work requires judging what counts as the shared history of two neighboring countries and what counts as colonization. Now, difficulty aside, interrogating monuments has become, for many Ukrainians, a powerful act of historical justice, similar to the removal of Confederate statues in the US or relics of apartheid in South Africa. In that process, according to the director of the commission in Lviv, the country can see what it's trying to protect and why its soldiers are fighting. Culture politics and language politics are safe places for every country because they're a part of identity. The museum documents Soviet and Nazi rule. Culture is important, just as is the army. Well, it's Q&A time. Questions and answers. Questions sent into the Smithsonian Institution and answers by their experts. Question number one today is, how did the body of a violin get its shape? Bowed instruments have existed for more than 1,000 years. But early examples, like those found in Arab lands, had only a few strings and they lacked a narrow waist. By the 1400s, instrument makers in Spain were building viola da gambas with as many as 7 strings. These instruments were built with narrow waists so musicians could bow the top and bottom strings without hitting the sides. It's generally accepted that Andrea Amati in Cremona, Italy, built the first 4-string violin in the 16th century. following the general shape of the viola da gamba. The violin family, including violin, viola, and cello, was refined by his grandson, Niccolò Amati, and Niccolò's followers, including Antonio Stradivari. You probably have heard that last name. And then this question. I've heard that purple was called the royal color because purple dye used to be scarce. Why didn't people just combine blue and red to get purple? Well, many purples in historic fabrics are, in fact, the result of coloring a fabric with a blue dye, of coloring a fabric with a blue dye, like indigo or woad, and a red dye, like madder. But the Tyrian purple associated with royalty, believed to have originated in Phoenicia, which is modern-day Lebanon, as early as 1200 BC. It was made by extracting mucus from snails found along the Mediterranean shore. It involved an expensive, labor-intensive process. Ancient writings suggest this dye was desirable not only for its brilliant hue, but also for its ability to stay color-fast over time. Similar sea snails are found across the world, and some cultures, like the Mixtec weavers in Oaxaca, Mexico, still use them for dyes today. And now we'll take one last break before we end today's show. Please don't go away. We'll be right back. Been a while since we've had wit and wisdom category on the program, so today, if you'll bear with me, here are some quotes from what noted people have said. Stephen Wright, comedian, has one that's, I think, quite amusing. And you'll have to work it around a little bit. He said, "What's another name for a thesaurus?" Yeah, work on that one. And then Samuel Weber said, "Laughter is dangerous to the guardians of the state, as to all good men, because of its tendency to get out of hand." Octavius Butler has been quoted as saying, "The only lasting truth is change." H.G. Wells, the noted author, has said, "Adapt or perish, now as ever. That is nature's inexorable imperative." And finally, Audre Lorde leaves us with this: "It's not our differences that divide us, it is our inability to recognize, to accept, and to celebrate those differences." Hooray. There's a good thought for the day. And we want you to stay tuned to this station, because in the next program, I'm going to be talking about cloud secrets, be talking about fog, and I may talk a bit about either storms or perhaps the celestial and the sublime. And you'll find out what I mean by that if you come back, tune in to 101.5 on your FM dial for a little of this and a little of that. Thank you so much for being with us today, because without you, gee, there's no reason for us to be here. We hope you enjoyed today's program, entertained, informed, and maybe you smiled a bit during Wit and Wisdom. Who knows? Maybe some other parts of the program were amusing in a way. Nevertheless, I want you to be safe, be kind to each other. That's the most important thing, huh? Well, Willie, you suppose we should get on the road again? Let's go look for some items to put in to the next program of a little of this and a little of that, as Willie Nelson and I go down the road again. Willie, take us home.